I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. We can buy just about anything online, and many of us do, from mattresses and mixers to clothing and shoes. And speaking of shoes, here's an old ad from Zappos about the convenience they offer consumers, especially the free returns.
Want to put a smile on your feet? Then experience shoe shopping the Zappos way. Superior customer service, free shipping, a generous return policy, free return shipping, helpful customer reviews, more than 500 brands, and just about 2 million shoes to choose from.
The convenience of shopping from home plus those generous return policies have resulted in a tsunami of returned merchandise. About a quarter of the items bought online get returned to the tune of $100 billion a year, but they don't always make it back onto the shelf. The cost and the logistics of managing the tons of returned items result in a lot of that stuff ending up in landfill somewhere or getting incinerated or shipped overseas. So it turns out that those free return policies are not free at all. They come with a cost built into the price of a product and the damaging impact on the environment. We have two guests who have joined us on Radio Times to talk about return policies. Amanda Mall is a staff writer for The Atlantic, where she writes about material culture. Amanda Mall, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And she joins us by Skype. Also with us is Hitendra Chattavredi, and he's a professor of supply chain management at the W.P. Carey School of Business at Arizona State University, author of a book titled Sense and Sustainability. He previously owned a reverse logistics company, which we will get to. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Amanda, let me begin with you and help us understand what the last 2 years of the pandemic, with all those lockdowns, those shuttered brick-and-mortar stores, what that has done to our shopping habits.
There has been a real trend toward moving your buying online, and that's for a couple of reasons. First, as you mentioned, a lot of people, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, just couldn't or didn't feel comfortable going out to stores, and a lot of stores in a lot of urban areas especially were closed if they weren't deemed essential. So people really had to turn online to find all kinds of goods that they might have been previously in the habit of just going out to pick up. And then you also have the issue of supply chain problems, which have been present in at varying levels for the past 2 years. Which means that people were also looking for alternate sources for things that they might buy in person that are just sold out, or things that they would have gotten at, you know, a website that they use a lot, and then that website didn't have it anymore. So you really get not only people moving their purchases online, but moving their purchases into parts of the internet that they had not really frequented before. And it's a big, really consequential swing in how people get the things that they need.
Well, picking up on that too, Hitendra, how have return policies, especially these online return policies, how has that led to over-consumption or over-shopping?
So, Amanda, great points. I think what consumers need to understand is that online e-commerce has a 3-time return rate than physical retail. So, for example, online now is about 15 to 20% of the total retail sales, which was at about 11% in 2019. So, e-commerce, people want to, since they cannot experience products, most of these e-commerce companies give a free return policy. And that return, just overall return rate at 3 times that of physical retail, is going to be touching in over the next 2 to 3 years about $1 trillion.
Wow.
And I'm not kidding.
Wow.
And that's larger than the GDP of Saudi Arabia, Switzerland, twice that of Israel, that of Argentina, 3 times that of Singapore. So you're right. This is a tsunami coming to us.
Well, Amanda, let me go back to you. And there are certain, I guess, languages of shopping online, bracketing, wardrobing. The idea, and let's focus on clothing, is, or shoes. You order, and I played a Zappos ad, you order you know, five different shoes, thinking you'll pick one. But the convenience of these return policies allows you to kind of do at home what you might have done in a store if you were sitting in the room there.
Yes, the incentive structures of online shopping were built to get past the friction that people feel when they're buying something that they need to try on, that they need to feel, when they're trying to do that online. Because there are real reasons that somebody might not want to buy a pair of shoes or a pair of jeans or a bathing suit online. So you have to, if you're a retailer, you have to create new policies that get past these objections and make people feel like they're not taking an inordinate risk. But what those policies do over time is they create a new set of behaviors in customers, because they incentivize a different way of interacting with shopping. So bracketing, as you mentioned, is the practice of getting a size down and a size up from what you think you probably need, because it's really difficult to tell if something's going to fit. And, you know, especially with lower quality clothing, sizing can be wonky, cuts can be inconsistent. So you end up buying three things in order to keep one thing. With wardrobing, what you're doing is taking advantage of the sort of permissive return policies, where if you know you've got a party coming up and you want to look your best and you don't really have like a dress or a pair of shoes that you love, or you'd love to wear something that you can't like quite afford, or you just know you're never going to wear it again, so why spend money on it? You maybe order something that looks great, that is expensive, that is fancy and impressive, and you wear it that night and you send it back because you know that you've got 2 months.
I mean, well, let me go back to you, Eitender, just picking up on that. Is that fraud? I mean, if you've actually worn something, I don't mean to be naive here, but if you actually worn something versus just tried it on and then put it back in the box, what are we dealing with here?
Yeah, I would call it more unethical and immoral type of behavior. There is fraud, though, by the way, of this. Today we'll be doing about $800 billion close to in returns. And 8 to 10% of that, which is up to $100 billion, will be fraud, which we really call fraud. What I mean by that is you are returning an empty bottle, or you're returning a dead mouse, or and claiming that I returned the product. So what you characterized, I would call it more unethical, because the e-commerce companies tell you they know it, they don't enforce, saying this is illegal, but there are illegal activities happening with e-commerce return, which are pretty significant.
Well, I wonder, Amanda, and I played an ad from Zappos. You sort of, I won't say blame, that might be too strong a word, but you say that Zappos policies kind of set the stage for these very generous return policies, which have created these problems for businesses, but also for the environment.
Yes, I think that everybody I talked to about this, when I asked them where this started, they said Zappos. Huh. And, you know, and if you think about Zappos's business model, especially in the context of when they were starting that business in the 2000s, it makes a lot of sense that they needed to do something in order to convince people to start buying shoes online. It's easy to forget now that online commerce is a big part of most people's lives, but it wasn't that long ago that the idea of buying a pair of shoes online was anathema, because you have to try shoes on. You have to get your foot measured in the little metal thing at the shoe store.
I remember that.
There are some, you know, very physical necessities around deciding you want to own a pair of shoes. So in order to get people to forego all of those, forego this entire process that feels necessary to them, you have to give them a lot. You have to be really willing to work with them and work with their anxieties and take the perceived risks away of doing that. So, and if you want to sell a lot of shoes, you are going to have to really push this out in front of your brand messaging. So, and Zappos was really, really phenomenally successful at that. Especially because they tend to sell stuff that is not super, super cheap. They have like a mid to high mid range of prices. They can absorb some of that cost a little bit better, especially at a really large scale. So they set up a situation that I think is still profitable for them. But they also set an expectation among consumers about how everybody else would act.
Well, and it sounds like, Hitendra, that other companies have followed suit. And I wonder whether underneath all this is this belief, this mantra that the customer is always right. And you know, we like customer service. But what has it gone too far, do you think?
I would turn in a different way, Marty, on this one. I think these companies know very well it is not about customer being always right. It is that if I give a good return policy, at the end of the day, the customer is going to pay for it. Mm-hmm. So people who are returning, they need to recognize the fact that the cost of return is already baked into the price that you're paying. And so what these companies are doing, and the reason they don't talk about return too much, and I think that's a big disservice to the consumer, because many people don't understand that there is this forward logistics or forward supply chain in which you're buying products, new products, but there is the second half of supply chain, which is this return supply chain or reverse logistics, as people call it. That is very, very significant. And since consumers don't know about it, many of them will return, will buy 8 items and keep 1 and return 7, not even understanding the impact and the pain that it's going to cause and subsequently the impact on the environment.
Well, and I'm curious about how much that drives up the cost. Let's say we're talking about shoes. The cost of a $100 pair of shoes, how much more are we paying?
If the return rate online is 25%, and if these companies, the return item when it gets back, let's say they get 30 cents to the dollar, so very easily 10 to 15% markup that the consumers would be paying.
And Amanda, does that square with your findings?
Yes, definitely companies pay a lot of attention to what their predictable costs are going to be when they're pricing products. And not only does that raise ultimately prices for consumers, but because there's a lot of price pressure on retailers because there's so much competition, it's also going to push them to lower other input costs. So you're going to look for products that are cheaper, made with cheaper materials, made in places that that do not pay their workers very well. You're looking to sort of balance all of these inputs, which means that not only might you pay more, but you might get a worse product in the future.
Well, we are talking about the impact of online shopping's rather generous return policies, which we are finding drives up costs and also fills up landfills. We want to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. That's Amanda Mull, staff writer for The Atlantic. Hitendra Chattavredi is a professor of supply chain management at Arizona State University. And we want to hear from you, especially if you buy online or maybe you don't buy online. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about the real costs of returns, return policies on the price of merchandise, also on the environment. The National Retail Federation says the return rate for e-commerce is between 20 and 30%, and it's even more for clothing. Again, talking with our guests, Amanda Mull and Hitendra Chattavredi. You know, I don't want to make too much of this, but as I was writing my questions, I was thinking about how with slaughterhouses, we don't want to go there to see the dark side of what it is to, you know, put a piece of meat on our table. And I wonder, Hitendra, whether talking about the sort of underside of supply chains and return policies, whether this is something that doesn't really get talked about because we really don't want to know what's going on.
That is correct, because it's a very, very pathetic life if you were to look back and say, a day in the life of a return. I'll give you an example. I was working in my company when I was working with a very, very large retailer here in the U.S., a retailer that is supposed to be very green and sustainable. And my business model was I was planning to buy some products from them, and I'm not going to name them. They said, great, we love to do business with you, and but we have one condition. I'm like, what condition is that? And these products were apparels and shoes and all the standard retail product. They said, the only condition we have is that if you buy these return items from us, and by the way, they were the clothes were in bale, literally. If you see the hay, the bale of hay, these return clothes were literally in a bale. And they said, you cannot sell these items in the U.S. You have to take these products outside the country. And I said, okay. And then are you okay, whatever I do with them? They said, do whatever you want to do with them. We don't care, but just do not sell these items in this country.
Wow.
Which is a symptom of like an ostrich with their head stuck in the sand. These items, most of them, in apparel particularly, 80% of these returns, our research has shown that 80% of these returns will end up in a landfill somewhere in a third world country. And we just close our eyes to it. You're right. That's a great example of a slaughterhouse. We don't want to know. Or as a matter of fact, many of these companies don't want us to know, because then we will start to ask questions. And one final point. It is not free. If consumers think that returns are free, no, it is not. The free return can never be free. And just one last data point. In apparels, just to give you an example, in 2021, online return was $180 billion of sales with a 40% return rate.
Wow.
That's a $72 billion of returns just in 2021 for apparels. And 80% of this is going to go into a landfill.
Well, let me pick up on that. And Amanda, you were talking about fast fashion and buying something that's, you know, relatively cheap, let's say a dress for $20 or $25. Help us understand, I guess, what happens with a return policy on that dress and how it might end up in a landfill, let's say in Ghana.
Yes, clothing, and especially fast fashion, really creates a unique set of problems for return policies, because what you have is retailers who are refreshing their assortment weekly, some of them daily, with just hundreds or thousands of new products. So things move very, very quickly in a lot of like really high volume fashion retailers online, which means that if you buy something and they have a 30-day return policy, you get it home, you try it on, it sits next to your door waiting to be taken to the post office for 2 or 3 weeks. When they eventually get it back, it's a month later. Because their business moves so quickly online, they might not have that product on the website anymore. There might not be a listing for it. It might be marked down to $10 or $5. And then the cost to get the item from your apartment to the sorting facility is going to cost $5, $10 for them. So they're already taking a loss, and then the item itself cannot be resold on the website because there's thousands of new things that have come in and it doesn't exist on the website anymore. So what they have to do is they usually sell it in bulk to a middleman who then exports it. So things may be sold via a wholesaler to populate stores in foreign countries and low income countries. But then, you know, when this stuff goes in by the container full to low income countries, and then you have to sort of sort through it. And a lot of this stuff is not going to be resaleable there either. So that stuff then gets discarded. And because so much of fast fashion is made of artificial materials, it's made of plastics that don't degrade, it goes to a landfill and then it just sits there. It just accumulates. It's not going to biodegrade. So you just have this ever-growing pile of stuff that is just not going anywhere, and it's not being used, and it was never worn, that has just been sent around the world.
Well, and I think we've seen pictures, and it's pretty amazing, Amanda. They're just the mountains of this discarded clothing.
Yes, there has been some great reporting in the past year, especially about what this looks like when it gets to the end of its life cycle. What your leggings that didn't fit or whatever look like when they get to the end of their life cycle, and they are just taking up natural space in someone else's country, who does not have the power to divert those elsewhere or to stop you from behaving like that. So we're visiting these harms on people who really don't have much power at all. What it looks like when you look at it is sort of breathtaking. And it's just really awful, but stores do not want you to know that this is happening. Brands don't want you to know this is happening because it creates some psychological friction from continuing to buy stuff. So stores are very, very secretive about this process. I contacted 12 different retailers for my story to try to get them to talk about what their return situation is at all. And Zappos, to their credit, was the only one who would talk to me. Nobody else would go near it.
Here's a comment from Mike related. Hi, Tinder. I'll put this to you. He says, can the guest comment on the untold hundreds, thousands of T-shirts and hats all over the developing world where, for instance, the Minnesota Vikings and or the Buffalo Bills are the Super Bowl champs? I mean, I've certainly seen people in African countries wearing 76ers shirts. And I'm assuming, you know, that's part of what Amanda was describing there. Hi, Tinder. Can you speak to that, especially as someone who, you know, was involved in this sort of reverse logistics system?
Yeah, and that's exactly where the source of these items are. But one of the other things you need to keep in mind, the body structures of different countries and the fashion sense in different countries is very different. So a shoe that goes from here all the way to, let's say, Africa or Asia, their shoe sizes, their shoe structures are very different. That's the reason I say a lot of these T-shirts are very easy to put on by people. But what about dresses, women dresses, shoes, high heels? Boots. Climate is very different. So a cold weather boot that gets returned, a big one, will land up over there with no use. So a lot of these items that are going over there, T-shirts and hats are examples of things that can get used. But majority of it, 80% of it, after getting picked, gets thrown into a big, huge landfill. And Amanda is absolutely right. I don't know if many of people know that in the U.S., per person is generating about 70 pounds of textile trash that will go into the landfill every year. 70 pounds per person that goes into the landfill.
We often focus on packaging, Hitendra, the environmental impact of packaging. But what you seem to be saying is that the items themselves have a more damaging impact on the environment.
No, that's actually a great point. There are a lot of people, I think we end up getting misled in a different direction saying, oh my God, look at all this packaging and it should be causing havoc to the environment. It is that packaging that you see, a cardboard package coming from Amazon or somebody, that's only responsible for 5% of the greenhouse gases because that could be recycled. But the product inside, the defective item, or that fast fashion 5 dresses that you're sending back, they're accountable for 48% of the greenhouse gases. And the rest of it is basically transportation and the greenhouse gases coming out of it. So it is the culprit here, the bigger culprit is not the packaging. The bigger culprit is that defective product that you're sending back and the retailers, and that most probably will end up getting into a landfill.
We are talking about the impact of generous return policies, which are so common when shopping online. Again, that's Hitendra Chaturvedi, and he's a professor of supply chain management at the Arizona State University. Amanda Mull is with us as well. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic, where she writes about material culture. And as always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call 1-888-477-9499. Amanda, going back to you, I mean, it seems like shopping is so streamlined. I mean, you can order something online, you get it within the next couple of days, but the, you know, the return is so much more unstreamlined, if I can put it that way, or complicated, or just difficult. Can you speak to that?
Yes. Two different experts that I interviewed for my story on this used the word nasty to describe what happens with reverse logistics. And that's because just from a procedural standpoint, getting a bunch of disparate distributed things back to one central location is just really, really difficult. You're going to have to receive every single one of those packages. You're going to have to open them. You're going to have to inspect the contents of every package to ensure that it is what it says it is. It is clean and usable, to see if the packaging with the barcode on it inside is present to scan it, and if not, try to piece together what it might be. That's extremely labor intensive. It is not. It is something that is very, very difficult to make efficient in the way that sending out prepackaged, barcode scanned, picked and packed products is just not inefficient, because you're dealing with, you know, the packing and direction following skills of the general public. And people are going to do a really varying job in following those instructions.
Hi, Chandra. You were in this business for a while. Is nasty the operative word?
Would actually agree with that. I'll add on to a few things that Amanda said, because I was living and breathing this process. Mm-hmm. The cost to process a return in majority of the items, and this is a very powerful statement, the cost to process a return in majority of the items will be higher than the value of the product. And imagine post-COVID, where these clothes have to be sanitized, even if you think about selling or reselling them, that adds an additional cost. Most of these items, when their box is open and their original packaging, they cannot be sold as new. So if consumers think that, okay, you can just iron them, clean them, put back in the box and resell as new and get the same value as a new item, that doesn't happen. That never happens. So yes, it is a process where every item needs to be scanned and processed and sanitized. So all the hygiene products, you will never see them being resold, because they're hygiene products. They end up getting destroyed. So this processing cost, and many, I don't know if you remember, there are computer companies who learned this lesson very, very quickly. And Amazon has started to do this too. When you buy a computer and you get a laser jet printer for free, if you decide to return that computer, most of these companies will tell you, hey, return the computer to us, but you know what? Keep the printer. Don't send it back. Mm-hmm. They realized it very early on that the cost to bring that free printer back to them will be higher than the value of that printer. Amazon has started to do this. If it's a cheap item, they will tell you to keep it. Don't return it. They just give you a credit for it. So yes, and they're doing it because this process has not been streamlined. Most of these companies have a line item in their income statement, and there is an expense line item, which is about reverse logistics. All they try to do is to maintain that cost of reverse logistics underneath that line item. If that happens, everybody's happy.
Here's a comment from Jonathan. Amanda, I'll put this to you. He says, I always buy the discounted stuff that's been open. Just bought two bar stools off of Amazon that were 10% discounted, and a taped up package of screws at the hardware store. So there are some people who are certainly willing to shop that way. But I wonder for companies, let's say, based in this country, I mean, there seems like there's so many other options, or certainly one option, which is to donate those returned items so that someone, you know, Goodwill could have a lot of fresh new merchandise that they could sell to their customers.
you know, some things do get donated. Some companies have good policies about that and work with nonprofits that can, for example, you know, place good winter coats with people who need them. Mm-hmm. But with a lot of merchandise, you get into the issue of what marketers call brand dilution, which sort of you end up saying the quiet part out loud, because the reason that people buy a lot of types of stuff is because they believe that it is special, because they believe that it is scarce, because they believe it's exclusive. That's why you might buy a certain type of handbag or a pair of shoes or jeans. So when these companies are dealing with their returns, it is sort of dangerous to that perception to then be donating things to people in need, which is, like I said, saying the quiet part out loud of what it means to brand a product, because then you risk people not feeling like it's worth it to pay full price for your sort of high-end thing. So you get a lot of very high-end fashion companies in particular just burning merchandise instead of discounting it, instead of donating it to someone who needs it, because it's too threatening to their marketing story to do anything else with it.
And when you say burn it, you mean burn it. Set
yes,
it on fire.
Incinerate it. Destroy
incinerate it. And the idea is that if it shows up at a thrift store for $2, then that hurts the brand, so to speak, Amanda?
Yes. You know, if you are trying to sell a pair of jeans for $70 brand new, and you have this entire brand story about why consumers should pay that much, and about all the care that you put into it, and about how you only, you know, order these in small batches from your producers and only use the best materials, and then that stuff ends up somewhere where it is should theoretically not be, that sort of fractures this universe of understanding that you're trying to create about why your product is worth all that money. And people buy stuff because they think it's special, because they think it is exclusive, because they think it's different than all the other stuff. That's not a case with everything that is bought, of course, but especially with fashion, you know, where this is such an issue. The belief that what you're buying is special is really, really powerful. And it's really, really powerful when it comes to getting people to pay higher prices.
And we have to hold on, only just because we have to take a very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. And if you were just joining us, we're actually talking about the impact of online shopping's very generous return policies and how it drives up the cost of merchandise and fills up landfills. And again, our guests are Hitendra Chaturvedi, professor of supply chain management at the Arizona State University, author of a book called Sense and Sustainability. He previously owned a reverse logistics company. Also with us, joining us by Skype is Amanda Mull. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic, where she writes about material culture and has been writing about the impact of these return policies. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at whyy. Radio Times, and you can give us a call, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. We have a couple of questions related to this, and Hitendra, I'll put this to you. Jack says, since we pay 10-15% more for products because of all the returns, are any retailers thinking about giving discounts with a no return policy, like maybe some airlines or like some hotels are doing? And a similar question from Nancy. Do you know the answer to that?
Yeah, I can try to address that. The biggest, so majority of the customers in an interview or survey that we did, majority of the customers have said that, I would say it's like 86% said that if we are going to get a bad return experience from any retailer, we'll stop buying from them ever again. This has spooked a lot of retailers, and they know that. A good return experience, which means free return, easy return, is just the lowest bar to get into the business. Mm-hmm. So these companies in which they are, and Zappos, great example you quoted, increase that bar to some extent. So companies don't want to give that you cannot return the product for a 10 or 15% discount. What will happen is consumers will go to their competitors. So they're not willing to take the chance of giving consumers 10 to 15% discount because you know what's going to happen? Many of these large companies, they're going to even take a loss in giving 15, 20% discount and push that competitor out of the market. So it's a dog-eat-dog world. So that 10 to 15%, they're not willing to take that chance.
But what you're both saying is that these return policies are really powerful incentives. Hatinder?
Exactly. That is a very, very powerful incentive. That's actually the bare minimum to just be in the game. And this is particularly hard for small companies. But you've got to give free return online, else nobody's going to come and buy from you.
Amanda, are there certain items, certain merchandise that actually if you do return them, or maybe even companies, if you do return them, they do end up back on the shelf and not being incinerated or in a landfill somewhere?
I'm really trying to think of something that...
Really?
Where that would,
it's that
where
hard.
That, would be
that hard.
I'm trying to think of something where that would be the norm. Because you've got like a lot of different types of problems and different types of products. Some of them are sanitary problems. Some of them are personal information problems. Any electronic that you like log into or put any kind of credentials into is going to be usually at best stripped for parts that are then sold. Kitchen stuff, sanitary problem, makeup, sanitary problem. Maybe books. I think potentially books would be like a pretty decent chance that they would be if they're, you know, intact and don't look like they've been open and read, probably they could go back into the ecosystem. But it is just really, really difficult to find a type of product where that is the norm.
Wow. And what about eBay? I mean, how important does it play a role, Amanda, in these return policies or just the return transactions?
You know, I think that eBay and other resale platforms are sort of an ancillary issue where if you, you know, accidentally outweigh a return policy, forget to take something, that is an option for you, especially with clothing. I think that has become popular for some people. You see secondhand marketplaces like Depop and Poshmark, where people, if they only plan to wear something a couple of times, they can just resell it on there instead of trying to return it. But I think that more than being something that's directly related to the issue of returns, it's something that is related more strongly to just the fact that there is so much clothing out there and so much of it is unwanted by the person who has it in their possession. And I think that people are trying to think about how they dispose of it because there's a lot of places that will shut down from taking donated clothing for periods of time because if people are cleaning out their closets, they get too much. They can't do anything with it. So I think that is something that has sprung up to deal with the overall issue, not returns itself.
I remember with some of these, natural disasters, Amanda, where Haiti and some of the other countries have said, don't send us your clothes. I mean, send us money. Don't send us clothes because it's just logistically too difficult to handle.
Right. And in something I learned reporting another story on the history of consumerism is that secondhand stores in these types of sort of quasi-charitable organizations that take clothes and other, home goods, things like that, were developed in part as sort of like a step in the consumer process, because it used to be that people bought a few things and kept them for a long time. And in order to get people to sort of cycle through their possessions and buy new stuff and be constantly refreshing the things that they own, they had to have a place to put their old stuff that they didn't feel like they were being wasteful. So a lot of these types of secondhand operations were spun up, you know, a century ago to encourage people to shop more by giving them a plausible deniability in creating waste. And a lot of them are just not like super efficient in how they give clothes back out into the world.
I hear you. Let me get PJ to join our conversation. And PJ, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. That's JP, sorry.
Oh, JP. I'm sorry. JP, I'm sorry about that. Go ahead.
No worries. I've been an engineer at a few of these major e-commerce companies. And one thing that people will talk about with a straight face and with dead seriousness is a customer obsession, an obsession with whatever details might make the customer choose you instead of one of your competitors. And so as a result, there's a never-ending arms race to coddle people, whether that means you get free shipping or free returns, or whether it means you don't like your order from DoorDash, and so the restaurant pays for it, or the driver pays for it. These costs tend to be either hidden from the customer or externalized onto somebody else in the name of customer obsession. My question for your guests is, are you seeing a change in consumer preferences as people become more aware of these costs? Or what would it take to move consumer preferences in a direction that would potentially make people more averse to business practices that incur these costs?
Two great questions. JP, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Hey, Tundra, let me toss that to you. And do you agree with JP that a lot of this is consumer coddling?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And it's consumer coddling, but the other hand is going into the consumer's pocket and saying, you're paying for this coddling. So that is what consumers don't realize. Having said that, the biggest issue that I see is deliberately or unknowingly, the customer not being educated. So most of the people don't even understand what happens to a return once they send it back. All the customers that we talk to, we had a retail business of these refurbished items, they had no idea the journey a return item goes and where it ends up. After a return, some of the research we have done shows that at least that product, before either it gets into the hand of a consumer that will use it, or it will be recycled or thrown in a landfill, it would have changed 5 to 6 hands. Mm. Means there are 5 to 6 middlemen between when the return actually gets initiated all the way to its final resting place. So there is, if this process and the impact that these returns are happening, if these companies are more open to the consumers, I think this new generation of consumers, the millennials, the Gen Zs, are more environmentally sensitive, and I'm sure that they will be a little bit more responsible. The problem is, at this moment, there's a lot of ignorance.
Well, and just a quick follow-up there, when you talk about the middleman, is there money to be made being a middleman or woman in this reverse supply chain?
Yes, there is, as a matter of fact, but the margins are very small. Just like any middleman, I buy something from somebody and I sell it to the second party within 15, 20 days. I make anywhere from 1.5% margin. That's the job of a middleman. So there are margins that are being sliced off all the way going to the end consumer, and still they end up getting it at 50% of the retail value. So many of these products, by the way, that are being sold by the retailers, these returns, they get what, 10 to 15 cents on the dollar? That's about it.
Amanda, Helen says this is yet another example of the horrors of capitalism. And it seemed, you know, whether we like it or not, people like to shop, whether they like to shop online or go to a store and do it in person. Is there a way to at least address this, what sounds like and feels like overconsumption, where you order 7 shoes, you look at them and keep one and send 6 back? Is there any way to address this?
I think that probably the best way to address it is regulatory. I, for a story I'm working on right now, I actually talked to a guy named Ken Pucker, who is previously the COO of Timberland, who works on sustainability issues now. And that was essentially the conclusion that he had come to, that if you want businesses to behave more responsibly and to pass those behaviors on to their customer base, then you are going to have to force them to do it. He said that a lot of that is going to mean making externalities like pollution and poor labor practices something that businesses have to pay for themselves. So if businesses are forced to deal with the amount of waste that they create, if they are forced to account for other types of harms that these behaviors create for people, then they are going to change their policies. And when you change policies, you change consumer behavior. I think that what we see right now is there are a lot of people who are concerned about this, but what they say that they want and what they say that they're concerned about does not match with their behavior, because the online shopping apparatus is so deeply embedded in our lives. It is really difficult for a lot of people to find what they want in their communities now, because a lot of stores have closed, a lot of things have consolidated. If you wear, a particularly large size or a particularly small size, if you are tall or short, you know, if you are outside this, you know, range that we make available in person for people to choose from, then you are going to have to go online. If you're busy, you're going to order some stuff from Amazon instead of going to the store, you know? So the way to sort of get these things and these behaviors out of people's lives is to change the incentives available to them, to change the ways of shopping that are available to them. Because when you change that, people change behavior. That's how we got people online in the first place. But you're going to have to provide them stuff in their communities.
Well, picking up on this Amazon question, here's a comment from Clive. I'll put this to you, Hitendra. Clive says, these businesses like Amazon have made it too easy to buy online. Even a spatula or small things. Shouldn't we be encouraging people to go back to brick and mortar stores? Can we sort of reverse trend that? Get people back into the stores?
Yeah, that's going to be hard. And what COVID has done is changed a lot of consumer behavior that I can, and this is where I'm going to use Marty PJ. In our PJs, I can buy anything sitting at home. I don't have to worry about it. What pandemic has done, and since literally 2019 to 2021, from 11%, literally, it has gone up to 15% e-commerce. That's a 4% increase of people shopping online. So that's a tough call. I want to comment something that Amanda said. Sure. About regulation. That's hard. And since I was in this business and since I had my businesses both in developing countries and developed countries, regulation, companies will find a way around it. For example, if many of these fast fashion companies are sending their products over to, let's say, a third world country or underdeveloped country, U.S. regulations won't be able to do anything. And that's what they find out. I think the biggest thing that needs to be done is that the consumers need to vote through their pockets. And they need to start to penalize companies who are not environmentally sustainable or they're not handling their returns properly. Because at the end of the day, it is fight for the pocket. And if we educate these consumers and they start to vote with their pockets, these companies will change their behavior, regulation or no regulation. Today I have seen, Mitch, I have gone to a CEO, a very large company CEO, with the regulation. He said, Hitendra, on a scale of 1 to 10, if 1 meaning I just do paperwork and I don't recycle anything, and 10 being if I were to recycle and do it everything by the book, what would cost me if I want to be at a 3? Means that's the kind of behavior that I have seen in my experiences, but I think the change is going to come with an educated and informed consumer. rather than regulation, because companies will find a way around it.
Well, one of the reasons we wanted to do today's show, to educate us all, and my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Hitendra Chattopadhyay, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Amanda Mall, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Amanda Mall, staff writer for The Atlantic. Hitendra Chattopadhyay, professor of supply chain management at Arizona State University. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs, or you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.